in Baltimore. Baltimore is well known for its healthy rate of opioid use disorders.
Right? Uh-huh.
Razors and heroin.
And with that, well, thanks, Dennis, for asking me, Chicago. I appreciate it. I'm going to be talking about medications for opiate dependence, and we're going to start with, like, why take a medication. And basically, you're better off not taking medications, but you're better off not having illnesses. So if you have a choice, don't have a disease. If you have a disease and there's an FDA medication that's approved that helps people, you should consider taking it or prescribing if you're a physician. And if you have a disease like opiate dependence, which frequently is lethal, then you really should, if you're a patient, a family member, or a physician, you really should consider using medications for its treatment. And this is, there are a number of long-term studies of opiate dependence in terms of natural history of opiate dependence, and this is a study done by UCLA of long-term of heroin-addicted people. And you can see this is the life course of it, and this is the percentage of people in the sample that were enrolled over time. And you see how many people were incarcerated from opiate addiction and the percentage of people who were dead over time. And the purpose of this is just to show you, and I'm sure you know, that addiction, opiate dependence can be a lethal disease. And the times actually when people are most subjected to possible death from overdose, which is a large contributor to death, or when people are detoxed. So there's research, a lot of research now internationally that when people leave jails or prisons, controlled environments, because their tolerance is lower, when they leave, if they relapse, the first event is often the death. And there's actually been some research in Italy also and elsewhere that's looked at people leaving detox units, not jails, but similarly, you know, a detox unit where the goal is to get people off, reduce their tolerance, and similarly when they get out, there's a much higher rate of overdose death from the 30 days when you leave a detox unit or a jail or prison. And so that's a really sobering fact that we need to be aware of, and patients should be aware of too when they're in these sort of situations. So there are medications for opiate addiction treatment, and these are well known to you, I'm sure. One is methadone, which I'm not really going to talk about very much because you're not methadone treatment program, so we'll just skip that one for the most part. There's buprenorphine, which is Subutex, which is the superior buprenorphine. There's a buprenorphine naloxone combination, which is Suboxone. There's oral naltrexone, which Dr. Fishman talked about, and injectable extended release naltrexone or Vivitrol. So all of those are FDA-approved medications for opiate dependence. And there are two kinds. Dr. Fishman again mentioned these categories. There are opiate agonists. They're full opiate agonists, which have the full strong effect, like methadone, and which is taken orally. There are partial agonists, buprenorphine, which is taken sublingually. And then the antagonists are naltrexone taken orally and Vivitrol, extended release naltrexone, which is an injection. So this is a depiction of the difference between opiate agonists, partial agonists, and antagonist medications. So here is the opiate effect up to 100%, whichever effect it is, whether it's being high or respiratory depression, which is a side effect that leads to overdose death, 100%, you stop breathing, so that's a bad thing. And this is the dose of the medication. So with methadone, as the dose increases, the opiate effect increases up until 100% effect, which leads to overdose death. And up here you're high and so on. Buprenorphine is actually a very strong opiate. People think that it's not, but it actually is a strong opiate at lower doses compared to methadone. But as you increase the dose, what happens is, for the most part, the effects plateau or level off. And that's why buprenorphine in the U.S. has been approved for prescription out of for opiate addiction in a physician's office, because you can take, you shouldn't, but you can take more than you should of buprenorphine, and it's very difficult to overdose on die of buprenorphine unless you're drinking or taking benzodiazepines like Xanax and so on with it. And then naltrexone has no opiate effect. So the higher just it's an opiate antagonist with like no opiate effect. So let's talk about the agonist first, which methadone buprenorphine. They activate the opiate receptors, and I mentioned that buprenorphine having a better safety profile because it's plateau effect at higher at some certain point with. There's just no extra effect if you keep taking a higher dose. They reduce heroin craving, alleviate opiate withdrawal, and this is the real, not for detox, but for maintenance or longer term treatment, this is the main effect that the medications have that people, typically patients, are not familiar with. The actual, even though it's an opiate agonist, because it's on the receptor, and if you're taking it at a regular dose, you're not like high and having euphoric effect. If you take extra opiates on top of an appropriate dose of buprenorphine, it blocks the euphoric effect of the opiate because the buprenorphine's already on the receptor and it binds like really tight to the receptor. So if you snort heroin, for example, I'm not recommending that, but if you were to snort heroin and you were on a good dose of buprenorphine, because the buprenorphine's on the receptor, the heroin can't get on. Okay, so it actually blunts or blocks the effects of opiates. And that's the effect that you want if you're prescribing as an outpatient, as outpatients, because you ask the patient, you know, they have a urine positive, for example, and you ask them, you know, gee, what happened? Well, my friends came home, blah, 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 and I used, and he said, and they're on 24 milligrams of buprenorphine. So you, next question you ask them is, you know, so when you use, how did it feel? Well, it wasn't as good as usual, blah, 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 you know, and that's, If they still got a buzz from the heroin or oxy or whatever, and they're on buprenorphine, it may mean that they're on an inadequate dose, and you might want to increase the dose. So that's like the key question that's often not asked: is did you feel it when you use the other opiate? So this is the chemical structure of buprenorphine. It's 3B, the one that you're more familiar with from your chemistry classes. And basically, this is an MRI pictures. Of the brain on top, and this is from PET scanning, and you can see that with no buprenorphine, the opiate receptors, which are the lighter colors, are showing up and absorbing the dye. And then with the higher the dose of buprenorphine, the receptors are occupied, and they're not lighting up. So since the receptors are occupied, if you take opiates on top of the buprenorphine, you don't get effect, and that's how the medication works.
Robert? A little louder for the back of the room.
Okay, sorry. Will do. So this is a graph that shows, a histogram that shows the effects of a change in opiate effect with buprenorphine dose. So if you give someone, this was with Demerol, and you're giving them, if they're not on buprenorphine, they get a lot of opiate effect, and if they're on buprenorphine and you give them, and you inject them, they get a lower opiate effect. And this was done with methadone in the 1960s. With giving people methadone in the laboratory and then letting them, you know, injecting them with morphine or heroin to show the blunting effect. And the same thing was done in the laboratories with buprenorphine, which shows, even in the laboratory conditions, that the effects of injected opiates when people take buprenorphine are blunted. So people say, well, you're just substituting one drug for another. You know, why are you giving them buprenorphine if they're opiate addicts? That doesn't make sense. But there is a difference between agonist treatment and heroin or OxyContin addiction. And that is, it could be the root, you can snort or inject heroin, but if you're taking agonist treatment, you're taking it under the tongue or orally. The effect of heroin or shorter acting opiates is immediate, the onset, which is part of the reason people get euphoric effect because the blood level goes up. And it's a slow onset if you're taking it as a medication. There's euphoria, obviously, if you're taking it to get high, and there's not if you're on an appropriate average dose. If you're buying drugs in the street, you often don't know what you're getting in terms of the milligrams, so there's more of a chance of overdosing and dying. And that is not true. The dose, obviously, if you're taking a medication, you know what the dose is. It's expensive to buy drugs in the street. The duration is much shorter for using drugs, you know, opiates to get high, like heroin. You know, one is legal and one not as legal. And the most important, the best for last, is if you're taking opiates to get high, your life is chaotic. You know, you're high, you're withdrawing, you're writing scams, you're going to different doctors to get prescription opiates, your family life is messed up, and so on. And if you're taking medication, that's prescribed for you and you're taking it appropriately and you're not using other drugs, you have a chance to have a normal lifestyle, normal family relationship. You can go to work and be a responsible citizen. You can go vote and do all those sorts of things that you want to do when you're a person in recovery. So the the partial agonist effect of buprenorphine, I mentioned, it's the ceiling effect, gives you more safety on higher doses. There's less chance of respiratory depression, less chance of overdose. It has a lower physical dependence. The withdrawal is not as bad if you stop taking it abruptly. I've talked to a lot of people who've been incarcerated on Suboxone. Unfortunately, a lot of jails don't continue medication when people are on legitimate medications when they're incarcerated. And compared to being on methadone or heroin, the withdrawal on Suboxone or buprenorphine is much, much less, which is not to say it's nothing, but it's much lighter than methadone or heroin. And then the Suboxone add naloxone, which is the opiate antagonist. It's the shorter acting naltrexone, essentially, if you will, that the ambulance drivers give people when they overdose. And so the Suboxone is a combination tablet. So the idea is that if people inject Suboxone and they're opiate dependent, it would precipitate withdrawal and they'd be less likely to continue doing it. Now, there are still two issues with that. One is they're less likely to continue doing that, but if you don't have anything else and you're opiate dependent and you inject Suboxone, you're going to get sick from opiate withdrawal. If you inject it again later, you're going to get less sick. And if you inject it again, you're going to get less sick. And at some point, you're not going to get sick from the naloxone at all, and you're going to just be injecting Suboxone. So just FYI, you can still inject Suboxone if you want to go through being sick. It's just that most people don't do it. In a setting where there's a heroin shortage and there's no heroin or other shorter acting drugs, there are people can be using Suboxone to get high on. In a setting in the United States, which is seems to always be awash with heroin at this point, and it's not really like a big issue. But I'm just, FYI. And similarly, if you're not opiate tolerant at all, you can get high on Suboxone with the naloxone in it. Won't have anything to precipitate withdrawal from if you're a naive person. Not a naive person, but if you're a naive opiate user and you use Suboxone. So those are just two caveats about Suboxone. Nothing's perfect, and this is another example that you have to be aware of. The adverse event profile, the side effect profile compared to placebo is pretty benign. This is some side effect list from a clinical trial. And basically, compared to placebo, the main side effect was constipation. That was significantly different. And buprenorphine is an opiate, so all opiates can cause constipation. And there was diarrhea, but this was probably in the dose induction phase. And all the other side effects were similar and not significantly different from placebo in the clinical trial. So there's a street narrative, of course, about every medication, and there's a street narrative about buprenorphine that we know from some of our qualitative research. And generally, thus far, the people who are out of treatment tend to hold buprenorphine in higher regard than methadone. People don't seem to have myths about buprenorphine, and I won't take it because it rots your bones or these things that people say that are not true but are kind of persistent. Ideas that just don't go away. There are people say, oh, it's easier to get off buprenorphine than methadone, which maybe it's because of its lighter opiate effects. That may be also because the physicians initially used it for detox, as a detox medication, and maybe that's influencing what people think. And we do know that buprenorphine is attracting people to treatment, many more people to treatment who would not go to methadone treatment. And that's for a variety of reasons. One of them is all the myths about methadone, which are not true about various side effects and so on. Part of it is the setting in which methadone and buprenorphine can be prescribed. Methadone is only prescribed in clinics, and you have to go to a clinic setting, and some people don't want to do that. There are rules in the programs and so on. There are only a certain number of sites you have to go to and travel to. In methadone programs, you have to get the medication 7 days a week. and so on. So if you're in, working in residential treatment programs or outpatient programs, it's actually, I think it's a blessing to have a medication that has a good safety profile that you're allowed to prescribe and that the patients can get a pickup at a pharmacy and like any normal medication, and the barriers to the patient adherence are much lower. And that's actually a good thing. So Suboxone has really just increased the number of patients in treatment with agonist treatment and in the United States, like actually quite substantially and quite quickly. And I think now there are more people taking Suboxone for opiate addiction treatment than methadone. And that happened in a few short years, and I think is a testament to the acceptability to both the physicians, prescribers, and the patients, you know, that need it and want to get it. So let's talk about, someone had mentioned, Mark and others I think had mentioned medication diversion, which is an issue for Suboxone and actually any other opiate, or actually any medication. People get Medicaid, get antibiotics with Medicaid, and you know, and then they sell it for money basically to people who don't have Medicaid, and you know, there are all kinds of people. You go to your cousin's got a toothache and someone else gives you like a Percocet and so on. So there's a lot of that going around just in general. And it's also certainly true for buprenorphine. So some patients give the medication, you know, they sell it so they get money, they take half of it, and then they sell the other half. You may know that buprenorphine has a long half-life also, and it binds very tightly to the opiate receptor, so you can actually take a double dose every other day, you know, and so you can take a Monday, Wednesday, Friday, you know, dosing, and so I'm sure some of the patients have figured out that if you skip a dose, it's not like methadone, where typically people would have some opiate withdrawal. So if you skip a dose, they could sell some of the medication and not have opiate withdrawal. So that's a possibility. Some people do it for altruistic reasons because their friends are sick from opiate withdrawal that they use with, and they say, try this, it works great. And some people give it to other people, and this is much lower percentage in the US, but you know, to get high, that certainly happens too. So as I mentioned, this has been a problem in some countries where there's a heroin shortage. I think if people are opiate, if they're addicted to OxyContin or to heroin, and there's a choice between buprenorphine, heroin, or OxyContin, most people are going to probably want to continue taking taking heroin or taking OxyContin. But if you don't have anything else, you know, I'm sure that people would want to take buprenorphine. There are some things you can do to minimize diversion, and that is, you know, increase the amount in your tablets in the prescription based on how well the patient's doing in treatment, right? So you know, a bad practice would be to give people like on the first visit like 30 days of medication. And I know that's happening to some extent in the community, and that's probably not a good practice. So you want to increase the amount that you give at commensurate with their time in treatment and how well they're doing. You might want to do some of that network therapy that Dr. Fishman was talking about, where you get to know the family members. That's usually a good practice anyway with alcohol and drug dependence treatment. You can ask people for, if you're not sure what they're doing, to bring in their bottles if they're in the middle of the prescription, so you can count the tablets, although that's obviously, and now they have the strips, right, that have like a little product code. So you can do that if you want to monitor people. And you could and probably should get urine testing. This is outpatient to make sure that patients are at least taking some of the buprenorphine, because if the urine test is negative, you know, that you have to have a conversation with them about why that would be. Medication diversion for any opiate is an issue that warrants attention, but you know, since opiate addiction is a chronic disease that can be lethal, then I, you know, the opiate diversion is a potential issue to deal with, but it should not be a reason not to prescribe the medication. Do you want to pause for a minute and see if this is an issue? Because someone had mentioned diversion, if there's some people want to talk about that at all.
I work for a local hospital, and we do outpatient hospital, my town hospital treatment. And we've, over the last few years, begin to see more and more patients getting smuggled into them, you know, discovering buprenorphine on them or admitting that they use.
Oh, when admission.
Yeah. Well, no, after they're in residential treatment, we have a pretty open campus.
Oh, I see.
So, you know, some people do try and bring things in with them, but others get it dropped off by visitors or that sort of thing.
Right, right. And that's an issue in all controlled environments. And I was in Puerto Rico, and they have actually, this is with heroin, but they put heroin in tennis balls and throw it over the wall. They're called pitchers, obviously. You know, they throw the ball over the walls and people catch the ball. Sometimes they get caught, sometimes they don't. I worked in a detox in Brooklyn years ago, you know, back in the day, and there were always people trying to sneak things in, family members, and obviously in prisons also. It's actually paradoxical, like in prisons, where they don't or should have opiate agonist treatment because there isn't any, but they smuggle heroin and so on.
Okay.
They also smuggle in Suboxone and other drugs. And part of it is the same idea that some of the people are treating their heroin withdrawal with Suboxone in the prison. And, you know, and there are newspaper accounts of, you know, Suboxone in prison and so on. And part of it is because there's no treatment. If there's no treatment available, you know, people are trying to figure out a way to get medications. But it's something you have to be very wary, you know, very vigilant of if you're running a residential treatment program. Contraband.
Yes, 20 please.
Minutes.
Okay. I run an outpatient program, and it's things that we're starting to see is A, there are doctors that aren't given up to 90 sometimes, and then the other issue is there's no treatment with it. And then the big issue is what we're seeing is two things. One is it really depends on their stage of change.
Right.
If they're really in the contemplation, pre-combat, just getting over the, trying to get over the withdrawal, then they're really doing a lot of diversion. The ones that are in preparation, moving into action, they're the ones that are more motivated. We're seeing a lot of success. But what we're seeing, what I'm hearing from the clients a lot, is they're going to do, they're sounding exactly what you're writing. What they're doing is they're using opiates for 2 or 3 days, and then they get back on their, they sold their Suboxone, pay for the opiates. Then they get back on the Suboxone just in time to do payment. And so they're on the Suboxone if you test them, and then if you test them for urine for the opiates, they're going to be clean too, depending on the test, because they can work it right 2 or 3 days, or they'll miss, oh, I had, you know, my mother sick or something like that,
right,
and then come in. So we're chasing. We're doing a lot of chasing.
Right.
And it's almost become detrimental it's not effective. And we're seeing eventually they drop out and they come back. Now the third or fourth time, they start moving in preparation in there. So Suboxone's effective, but it really depends on what stage of change they're in. And that's a difficult thing because they get contemplation to move forward, but the doctors prescribing it are not managing it well at all. And then let me rephrase it, some doctors are not prescribing
sure
that well. And then, you know, addicts are great. They know how to be one step ahead of us. So that's kind of what we're seeing with Suboxone.
Yeah, thanks for sharing that. I have 3 comments. One about the physicians. It's always good to have your physician call their physician. I like calling.
They typically don't call back.
Yeah, exactly. I love doing that.
As soon as I see the doctor, I know what stage of change they're in. Because
right,
everybody knows in the area what doctors to go to.
Right, right. But that's a very good thing. I'm glad that your doctor does that. The other issue is, you know, with using and what people are doing, if you're not sure what's going on with the patient, that's what I was saying before, it's really nice to have contact with the family if they have some, so you really know kind of, you know, what's going on. And that's true with schizophrenia and heart disease and other things in the family is important. The other thing is, you did mention something about counseling and not getting the treatment and so on, but I will note that there was just a large study at the Clinical Trials Network that Roger Weiss did, and there's other research. So the medication, if people stay on the medication, depending on what stage they're in and so on, they actually can do well even without the counseling. And the question is, you know, you're trying to, if you have a chronic disease and it's an outpatient, you want to keep them in treatment and be involved with them. And they'll slip and then play games with you and so on. But if you have them and you have a rapport with them, like it sounds like you do, the best, you know, if you can figure out ways to keep people in treatment and keep working with them. That's how people have the best outcome the longer time that they're in treatment.
Well, one of the clients that I saw, I thought he spoke for a lot of clients in the PCS, but he finally got on Vivitrol. And one of his comments said that he had been on Suboxone for over a year, didn't have any counseling. His doctor never told him to be on counseling, got over on the doc, his family was upset. He said for a year and a half he was playing this game.
Yeah.
He was doing this. And he said he was so excited to be on Vivitrol because he couldn't play that game. It took it out of his hands.
Right. And that's why it's great to have a lot of different, not a lot, but at least a couple of different medications. And over the course of people's treatment career, sometimes Suboxone might be good for them, sometimes Vivitrol, sometimes Methadone, sometimes just going to NA meetings. So, it's good to have different options. Now, you know about DATA, which is the Drug Addiction Treatment Act, which before opiate dependence could only be treated in Methadone programs. And for almost 90 years, physicians were prohibited from prescribing opiates for opiate addiction. And so this buprenorphine, this change from this Drug Abuse Treatment Act and the approval of buprenorphine is just a huge difference. You know that methadone, we could skip this, I think. You know that methadone can only be provided in opiate treatment programs. And buprenorphine can be prescribed from in outpatient counseling programs. And do you, in your outpatient practices, do you start the patients getting the medication under observation and then switch them to prescription, or do you prescribe straight off, or do you both? What do you guys do?
It's given, it's monitored, and then if it's a good fit, then
yes,
we'll get a script and be hooked up with a follow-up physician.
Right.
Okay.
Okay, that's great. And you could do it in physician offices. You can have detox and shorter opiate treatment for detox, and longer term can be maintenance. And the length of time should really be individually determined. So I know some of the patients say, how come do I have to stay on this medication my whole life? Right? The families want to know that. And, typically what you say, what we talk about is, let's take it a little bit at a time. And, you've been using OxyContin and heroin for 7 years, and so why don't we do a few months at a time and see how you're doing? And the real problem is more people dropping out than staying on it their whole life, and that's often the main challenge. But the length of time should be individually determined. So we know that detox with opiate agonists are highly effective at reducing withdrawal symptoms. It helps some people remain drug-free after detoxification. And if you want to get off all medications, it's necessary but not sufficient because the relapse rates are very high. One of the studies from the Clinical Trials Network from Dr. Ling, UCLA, and others showed that there was an 18% abstinence rate from opiate detoxification 1 month after detox. This is detox with Suboxone, and this is a multi-site national study. And so the rates of of abstinence after a month are like 20%, 30%, and so on. So, which is not to say that no one stays abstinent, but there's a very high relapse rate. This is true both for inpatient detox and also for outpatient detox. So, this is a rationale for taking for medication if people are on a residential unit because there's a high rate of relapse when you're off medication in the first month, even if you're in a residential unit. It should be presented to patients, ideally, that this is an option for you. It'll increase the chances of you staying abstinent and not getting re-addicted to the opiates that you were using. I think it's also fair to tell patients that, you give them the informed consent and you tell them that your chances of overdose death and of relapsing are higher if you're not on the medication than if you're off, which is not to say you have to take the medication, but it's like any medical treatment. If you don't tell people the risks and benefits, you tell them what the side effects are and what the problems are, what the cost is, and what the risks of not taking the medication are. I know quality assurance, like with heart disease, we know from trials that if you take aspirin, a beta blocker, and a cholesterol medication, if you've had a heart attack, your risk of dying is diminished. Mm-hmm. And so if you had a heart attack and you were in a hospital and the doctor didn't offer you those medications and tell you why you should take them, that could certainly be considered malpractice now. And, you know, you might want to not take them, you know, because that's up to you, and it is a free country, so patients should be able to decide what they want on their own. But, you know, it's important in cardiology to inform the patients, and I think it's coming closer to that also now in medical care with addictions as well. We know that longer-term treatment with agonists work. It reduces heroin use. Multiple clinical trials show that. Reduces criminal activity, reduces HIV risk behavior. Effective maintenance treatments, the higher doses, the better the outcomes, although individualized to a particular patient. The longer people stay in the medication, the better they do. And, you know, people should get psychosocial treatment appropriate, level of intensity and appropriate to their needs. This is just a study from Dr. Ling again from UCLA, a multi-site study, and basically it shows the percentage of patients with 13 or more consecutive opiate urines in this trial, and this is 1 milligram, 4, 8, and 16 milligrams of buprenorphine. So in this trial and all the others, the higher the dose, the better the outcome. We know from the clinical trials buprenorphine is better than placebo. It's equally effective as moderate doses of methadone. This is a trial from Ed Johnson that was published, I believe, in JAMA, and it shows the retention, the percentage of patients retained in the trial. This is higher dose methadone out to 17 weeks. This is buprenorphine, and this is low dose methadone, which was the equivalent of basically giving placebo, I think it was 20 milligrams. So this is a much higher, and they all got counseling in this study, it's a much higher retention rate with buprenorphine or a higher dose methadone. And this is from the same study showing the percentage of opiate positive tests. So again, this is the placebo equivalent, the low dose methadone, and this is the buprenorphine and the high dose methadone. So this is about a 50% opiate positive rate, which is not, like Mark was saying, we don't have a silver bullet, what do you call it, silver bullet. Or magic, but you know, 50% reduction, you know, it beats nothing, like for sure. And urines don't tell the whole story clinically. When sometimes I know, like in clinical programs where I've worked, sometimes the nurses or the counselors will go, oh, the patients, you know, blah, they complain about a particular patient. They'll say, patients, you know, his urines are still positive for opiates, where they're not coming to counseling regularly, and they have opiates. So you know, we want to discharge them. We want to discharge them. And I say, like, was the patient doing better when they came in? You know, when they, what, are they doing now better when, or are they doing better now than when they came in? Well, yeah, you know, he's eating, he looks healthier, he's washing, he looks better, his mood is brighter. So, well, it seems to be helping. You know, it's not perfect yet. Let's keep trying to work with the patient. And then the other thing that's interesting is also, with the urines, even though we use them in clinical trials and in monitoring, but it's really a patient and a person that we have before us and their clinical situation. And like with the data, DSM, we have the criteria for DSM, which are not like number of opiate positive urine tests, it's like functioning, right, in terms of their behaviors in the community. And people could have opiate positive tests and still not meet the DSM criteria for dependence. They could have their dependence basically in remission. And I just think that's an important clinical point to recall.
5 minutes.
Okay, great, we're almost done. Do any of you have pregnant patients? Do you use, are you using buprenorphine at all for pregnancy or?
It's not really, if there's a special circumstance we have, but we'll primarily use methadone.
Okay, so there's a new study that was just, was published last year, so I didn't do it, but basically the outcomes in the study that showed that the drug treatment outcomes were about the same in this multi-site clinical trial with methadone buprenorphine, and they used Subutex, so it didn't have the naloxone in it. But the neonatal withdrawal and the number of days in the hospital, you know, postpartum, were lower for buprenorphine, and that's more, you know, becoming an idea to use buprenorphine instead of methadone. For treatment for pregnant women. These are the opiate antagonists. Mark talked about, that's naltrexone on the left. We talked about oral naltrexone, which again is the same thing with alcohol. It's difficult to get people to take. But if you have monitored treatment, it could be an option, and obviously it's like a lower cost. And you can take it three times a week, you know, every other day, like 100, 100, and 150 milligrams. So it's good for highly motivated patients, like doctors who are going to lose their license, or pilots, and you know, things like that. And then you have the Vivitrol, which Mark talked about, which lasts for about 30 days for the injection. And basically, this is from the clinical trial that got the Vivitrol approved in the United States by the FDA. So this is a pivotal clinical trial that was done in Russia. And basically what you see here is, this is the percentage of opiate-free weeks, and this is the cumulative percentage of patients. So, and these are the people on naltrexone injection, and these are the people that were getting placebo. So at half of the number of patients, you can see there's a very wide difference in the number of people who were able to have drug-free, opiate-free weeks. And with the naltrexone, half of the patients had 90% of their opiate-free weeks during the trial. And the placebo, half of the patients had only 35% opiate-free weeks. It's a very wide difference. And in terms of total abstinence during the middle of the trial, there were 35% of the patients in the Vivitrol group versus 22% in the placebo group that had total abstinence. And so, again, Vivitrol is not 100% perfect, but compared to not getting Vivitrol, it increases your odds of not using opiates. And basically, because if you use on it, it blocks the effects, you don't feel it anymore, the patients have a choice of either stopping to come to get the injections or stopping to use the opiates, because it's just a waste of money because they're not getting any effect. And so Vivitrol is also like it's a really good medication for people in controlled environments, like if you're leaving a detox or a rehab unit, or if you're leaving jail or prison, because you've already been detoxed, and you need to be 7 to 10 days opiate-free before you get Vivitrol. So I don't know how long your residential programs are, but if they're, if you have a short detox and then they have about 7 days of being opiate-free, you would be able to use Vivitrol. And certainly it would protect people in the month that they get out from possibly overdosing, even if they don't stay in treatment, and it gives them like a head start not having to worry about, you know, using, and it would permit them to go to counseling and to go to NA meetings. And so I think it's like a really, seems like a really perfect option actually for residential treatment programs. So I'm gonna stop with that, and if there's other discussion, we've had some in the middle, except that that would be like a good timing, but if there are other discussion points, why don't we have those now?
I have a question. Earlier, you had said that patients have figured out that they can take their Suboxone every other day, or Monday, Wednesday, Friday. Is that correct?
Well, you can prescribe it or give it in under direct observation, or even prescribe it every other day. But some of the patients, you know, nowadays you forget a dose of anything like an antibiotic, and they don't get sick, and they figured out that they could skip a dose.
So they figured that out. I guess my question is, how many practitioners, doctors prescribe it that way as opposed to daily? I mean, does that even make sense?
I think it makes more sense in an environment where you want to monitor. Like if you're in an IOP,
right,
for example, and you want to give direct observed treatment and you want to start people, you could do it that way. I don't know of a lot of doctors, maybe Mark to you, that actually prescribe every other day, because you could take it. It's harder to remember to take something every other day, I think,
right,
if you're out in the real world.
Okay, well, thank you, Robert. There's a